I just had a drink with Jack, Charlie said one night. He says Charity hates him. He says Charity is why Grace quit.
You went over to see Jack? Nora said. Did he tell you that he refused to write Grace a recommendation after 21 years? Which had been immaterial because Sherry had written a fulsome recommendation, according to Charity, and Grace was already working for a couple who lived on Central Park South and, according to Charity, were paying her more for less work.
Don't start with me about Jack, and tell Charity to leave the Fisks alone.
Nora would do no such thing, although she felt a slight spasm of sympathy for Sherry. Having Charity angry at you was like being caught in a thunderstorm. Charlie didn't know about the men in the SRO or the dog leavings, which had stopped all winter long and now had appeared again. But George had told him all about the rats, and Nora suspected that Charlie was glad of the news. He was certain there were no rats in gated communities in North Carolina. I bet there are a lot of snakes, Nora had muttered to herself.
You're not really moving, are you?
Rachel, home for a few days, had said that morning.
What do you think?
Nora said, as she packed up her tote bag and waited for Rachel to find her jacket, which was somehow under the coffee table in the den, and was somehow actually Nora's jacket.
I think Daddy is a little crazy for some reason. I think pretending he believed Mr. Fisk's ridiculous story made him crazy. I also think if you move to the places he's talking about moving, you'll scarcely ever see me because why would I go there?
I hope you told him that, Nora said as they left the house.
Are we getting a cab?
Rachel said.
I always walk, Nora said.
Okay, Rachel said. It's a long walk, Nora said. And Rachel just shrugged, which was how Nora knew something was up. Even if Rachel was amenable to a walk, tradition would dictate that she should argue about it. A cab was more comfortable. What about the subway? No one else walked to work. Whatever.
Doesn't she know that she's only feeding rats? Rachel said when they came upon the woman with the baguettes, surrounded by a gaggle of geese and a cloud of rapacious gulls.
Nora shivered. She could still see the rat in the Lessman stairwell, the shadow of its long, hairless tail. Rachel was almost as crazed about rats as her mother.
I don't get you guys, Oliver had once said. He had spent a good deal of time with lab rats. I bet if you got to actually hold and watch rats, you would get over this.
Are you insane? Rachel said.
What she said, Nora added.
Okay, Mommy, no, don't try to be cool, Rachel said. It's so sad when you do that.
The pieces of French bread hit the ruffled gray water and then were hidden beneath the flapping wings and snaking necks. A spring breeze was blowing Nora's hair around her face, and Rachel's hands were pushed deep into the pockets of the leather jacket she'd worn, despite the fact that Nora had told her she would need a heavier coat. True spring came a little later right along the river. Two windsurfers in wetsuits went by, waving at them.
Insane, Rachel said.
Is that my jacket? Nora said. During high school, Rachel had made criticizing her mother a hobby, especially in terms of appearance and apparel. Nora understood that what she wore fell into two categories as far as her daughter was concerned. Things too lame to be allowed to pass without censure, and things that, in Rachel parlance, she could jack. Sometimes when Nora bought a blouse, she could almost feel it slipping from her shopping bag directly into Rachel's duffel. But it usually happened before the tags were even off the garment, before Nora had had a chance to actually wear it, and she had assumed pollute it with her lameness.
Technically, yes.
I've had that jacket forever, Nora said. Jenny picked that jacket out for me years ago.
See, and you never wear it anymore.
Which was not really true, but Nora suspected she might never wear it again. It looked good on Rachel, which would not have escaped Rachel's notice. She wondered if Rachel had passed into her retro phase, in which she would take Nora's things if they had somehow been sanctified by the passage of time and the boomerang nature of fashion trends. She and Jenny had marveled over a magazine piece that said the leather bomber jacket was back. As if it ever went away, Jenny had said disdainfully.
So you're really almost done with all your work?
Nora asked her daughter.
It's amazing how little there is second semester senior year, Rachel said.
Nora remembered. It had given her endless hours to think about James and whether he would change his mind, which seemed pathetic to her now. Nora tucked her hair behind her ears.
I'm glad you're not blonde, Rachel said.
What?
All my friends' mothers get blonder the older they get, or at least all my friends in the city. It's like a gateway to gray, I guess. I saw Elizabeth's mom last night, and she is totally blonde. It looks weird.
Isn't she Brazilian?
She says she's from Venezuela. Is there a big difference?
In Brazil, they speak Portuguese. In Venezuela, I think they speak Spanish.
I can't imagine her blonde, but she did have that unfortunate surgery when you were juniors.
Her face is kind of relaxed now, Rachel said.
That's another thing I'm glad you haven't done.
Bibi had once suggested that Nora's forehead could use a little bit of a lift, and that the lines around her mouth might be made to vanish, but she'd ignored her. She figured it was like her professional ambition. She simply didn't have that internal yearning for a smooth jawline or dewy skin that seemed to drive so many of the women she met. Part of it was Charlie. There were many uncertainties in her life, but Charlie's carnal response to her continued unabated. When he was uninterested in sex, it was more about how he felt about himself than how he felt about Nora. If he was having a bad week, he would watch her strip for a shower and say somewhat sadly, "Your butt still looks like $1 million."
So, Mommy, Rachel said after a moment of silence, this might be a good time to discuss my plans for after graduation.
Oliver was already set with a job working as an assistant in the same lab where he had worked as a student. Nora had assumed Rachel would return to the city of her birth to pursue the kind of job that liberal arts graduates pursued, the kind that required their parents to pay their exorbitant rent for at least a year or two, even though they were living in tiny apartments designed for one person, with two roommates and a temporary wall down the center of the bedroom.
I've been offered a job by a great company in Seattle with excellent opportunities for advancement, and I've decided to take it, Rachel said, so fast that the words blurred together, which again meant that there was more to this than her daughter was saying.
Nora was silent for a minute or two. Then she stopped and looked at Rachel, and the fact that she had to look up at her, that her daughter was 3 inches taller than she was, combined with the strengthening wind, brought tears to her eyes.
Oh my God, don't cry, Rachel said. It's not that far. There are nonstop flights every day.
Nora laughed. It's the wind, she said. And the fact that you've left out the most important part of this announcement, which is that you're going to work for Christine, correct? And I just got off the phone with her and she didn't say a word.
I wanted to tell you myself. Daddy's going to kill me, isn't he? Those nice people who used to live down the block from us, he used to say they were in the rag trade, as though they were street peddlers or something, even though they were majorly rich.
He'll be fine with it. It's a great opportunity. I know you know this, but I thought the business was ridiculous when my sister first told me about it, which shows how bad I am at putting my finger on the future. Little did I know that someday people would be wearing yoga pants to work, which, by the way, I still think is a terrible idea.
It's just, I don't know, all my friends from high school, most of my friends from college, they're all coming to the city, which, by the way, is kind of obnoxious, isn't it, that we call it the city? There was a girl in my seminar from Paris. She said to me one day, "You know, Rachel, there are other cities in the world."
I suppose. Rachel laughed.
I think that's exactly what I said. But anyhow, I realized everyone would wind up here, and we'd all go to the same bars and the same parties, and it would be like a continuation of my childhood. And I don't want that. You didn't have that. When you came here, it was a brand new life for you.
I'm not arguing, Bug. This is a really smart, mature decision. I'm gobsmacked and awestruck.
SAT words, said Rachel.
Right, said Nora.
Are you mad at Christine?
Why? Because she treated you like a grown-up? Wow, you really underestimate me. When do you start?
2 weeks after commencement. I'm staying with her until I get an apartment. I'm hoping for an August 1st move-in.
Oliver's and Rachel's commencements were a week apart.
Oh, Jesus. Talk about crazy, Charlie had said. 2 days of events with one, 2 days of events with the other, like a triathlon for the parents.
3 days of events, Nora had said. But I talked to a woman once who had twins at different colleges whose commencements were on the same day. I'm just relieved we don't have to deal with that.
Nora and Rachel turned onto the museum block, shoulder to shoulder, in the companionable silence of two people, one of whom had had something momentous to say, one of whom knew she was going to hear it, and both of whom had gotten it over with. Phil had thrown off his blanket and turned his face,
with its stubbled chin to the thin April sunshine.
Beautiful day, he said to Nora.
Phil, this is my daughter, Rachel. Rachel, this is Phil. Hi, Phil, said Rachel, shaking his hand, which made Nora proud. That's so you, Rachel said when they'd moved down the block, to know a homeless guy. He's not really homeless. That's even more you, to know a faux homeless guy.
Stop picking on me, Nora said.
I'm not picking on you. I've decided not to pick on you anymore. Rachel put her arms around Nora. My little mommy, she said, standing on tiptoes so she could put her chin on the crown of Nora's head.
Want to come up and meet my new assistant?
Richard? Rachel said.
Love him.
Love. We're phone friends. That girl you had before was just the worst. Tell Richard I'll meet him in person next time. I'm late for brunch. I might go shopping after.
Nice girl!
Phil shouted down the block when Rachel had disappeared.
Yep,
Nora said, and went inside, where one of their curators, a young woman they'd just poached from Tiffany's, was waiting.
We have a major problem, she said before Nora was even halfway across the lobby.
We've got a major problem, Nora said when she finally got through to Bibi, who refused to carry a cell phone.
I didn't come this far to answer my own phone, she'd said when Nora asked why.
Which is? Bibi said.
Nora could hear the clank of dishes and realized her assistant had probably tracked Bibi down at the Breakers in Palm Beach. She had told Nora the hotel had the best niçoise in the world, although Nora suspected there was probably some place in the country of France that would argue with that.
The Star of Kashmir, Nora said.
Annabelle says she thought that it was sitting a little oddly on its stand when she looked this morning. She took it to the gemologist, who looked at it carefully, and says it's a copy. A very good copy, but a copy. There was a long silence. Nora thought Bibi was thinking, then realized she was chewing.
So?
Bibi said.
So? Bibi, that necklace is one of the most valuable pieces in our collection. The insurance estimate was $8 million, and that was 4 years ago. Even then they thought it was low.
It was low. Norman said it was worth at least 10, and that was when the market was depressed.
So what I'm telling you is that it's gone, and there's a copy in its place, which is a major crime as well as a major disaster for the museum. We should call the police and the head of security firm immediately. We also need to figure out how to handle this so the PR fallout won't be terrible. My understanding was that we had a fail-safe system here.
The greatest hazard of running a museum of jewelry, she had learned early on, was security. Unlike a significant Vermeer, say, or the skeleton of a T-Rex, an important necklace was both portable and fungible. A thief might not be able to dispose of it as configured, but it could be turned into a handful of stones and still be valuable. Nora had been happy that they had gotten publicity nearly everywhere for their innovative display cases, which were designed to deliver voltage sufficient to disable a 200-pound man if they were broken or opened without a complicated computer authorization. One of the local TV reporters had even volunteered to be zapped by one of the cases, but the museum's insurance firm thought that was unwise.
You accidentally kill somebody on camera, it would be bad, the security chief said. But trust me, we tested it on one of our guys and it worked. It definitely worked, said a broad-shouldered man who Nora thought looked as though he'd played college football, and the way he said it made her think he was the person they'd tested it on.
Bibi had negotiated hard, demanding a clause that if anyone was electrocuted, the manufacturer would be responsible for damages. She was a shrewd negotiator, in part because she acted a little dim at the beginning of any discussion. The men on the other side of the table were always lulled into a false sense of supremacy until she pulled her real personality out of her pocket and laid it on the table.
I don't want some thief whose brain is fried suing me for $1 million, she said of the liability clause,
which the manufacturer had eventually agreed upon.
They swore those cases were fail-safe, Nora said, tapping a pen on her desk and staring at a list of who had the computer codes.
Hold on, Bibi said, and Nora heard her put the receiver down. I want the berries, but no whipped cream and no blackberries, just the strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries, but no whipped cream. Last time I had to send it back.
Nora heard her lift the phone again. The maitre d' must have brought her the restaurant phone, the way they did in old Hollywood movies.
You there? Bibi said. Don't get your panties in a twist. That necklace is sitting in my home safe.
What?
It has sentimental value. It's the last piece Norman ever gave me. I was going to that black tie thing at the Pierre, and just for one night, I wanted to wear the real thing. Not that any of those people would know. There was a woman there with a diamond as big as a ping-pong ball on her one hand, and I can tell you that it was no more a diamond than I'm Marilyn Monroe.
That was months ago. All that time we've had a paste copy in that display case?
I told you years ago, no one uses paste anymore. And my copies are the best copies. I'm surprised anyone even noticed. When I'm home from Palm Beach, I'll put the real one back.
Bibi, we've been telling visitors that what they're seeing is the Star of Kashmir.
And they never even notice the difference, right? So who cares? If nobody can tell the difference between real and fake, who cares if fake is what you're showing?
PR Newswire. Attention, local outlets. Museum begins search for president. The Museum of Jewelry will be searching for a new president with the resignation of its current leader. Nora Nolan, who has overseen the museum since its opening 5 years ago, will leave at the end of the year, according to Bibi Pearl, the chair of the board. Nora has been the heart and soul of my fabulous brainchild, Mrs. Pearl said from her home in Palm Beach. She's also become one of my closest friends. She will never stop being a part of the Museum of Jewelry. Mrs. Pearl endowed the museum and donated nearly all of her extensive collection of fine jewelry to it after the death of her husband, Norman, a real estate developer whose personal wealth was estimated by Forbes at slightly over $3 billion. There was skepticism in the museum community about what was often seen as a vanity project, but the museum has been unexpectedly successful under Ms. Nolan's leadership. No reason was given for her resignation.
Friends, Andrew, Josh, and I are having a small private funeral for Jack, but we would welcome some time with all of you at our home, and we'll be receiving visitors from 6 to 9 p.m. this Tuesday. Please come by and share some stories about their father with the boys. Fondly, Sherry.
Rumor had it that Jack Fisk had hanged himself. The funeral director had made the mistake of using the word suddenly in the paid obituary, which was technically accurate, but in recent years had become a kind of covert shorthand for suicide. There was speculation that the remorse over what he'd done to Ricky or anxiety over the outcome of the case against him had broken him. But Nora knew that Jack had as little of remorse in what Sherry called his emotional toolkit as any man alive, and Linda Lessman had heard through the courthouse grapevine that there had been some deal made, that Jack would not be criminally prosecuted, that he could even continue practicing law. Ricky's account of what had happened now apparently dovetailed roughly with his.
I wonder how much that cost, Linda had said. I never even knew the guy had a bad heart, Charlie said.
I didn't think he actually had a heart, said Nora.
Enough, Charlie said.
Charlie believed that Jack had died of sorrow. Nora thought he died of bile. Maybe it was a chemical reaction of the two, like the baking soda and vinegar volcanoes the kids had made in school. In any event, it was certainly natural causes. Whenever Nora imagined disaster, it was always dramatic, the plane on which they were flying to Bermuda plummeting into the Cerulean Sea, a cab rocketing around the corner and sending her flying while her children watched in horror. When the twins were small and she was carrying them, she would always imagine stumbling. She endlessly rehearsed spinning, falling, cushioning them, so that her own body took the full weight. But the crises were never what you thought, always more pedestrian. Ollie sliding down the banister and breaking his collarbone, Charlie complaining that she'd served bad shrimp and then having to have his appendix removed. Jack had apparently told Sherry he didn't feel well, took 3 Advil, lay down in the den, and died sometime between the evening news and the end of the Yankees game, with the Wall Street Journal open on his chest.
I don't know that I'll ever make my peace with the idea that I was downstairs in the living room reading for all that time, and he was either dying or dead, Sherry said the next morning, while Brutus pulled mulishly at his leash, his black eyes glittering as Homer sat patiently next to Nora. Everyone on the block had salved themselves with the idea of Jack's as a good death, falling asleep in his recliner chair,
without months of chemo or a long hospitalization or what none of them said, the perpetual disgrace of being the guy who'd done that terrible thing to the poor handyman. But Sherry was not part of that hallelujah chorus. She had not seen her husband for hours, perhaps because it had become second nature to avoid him, and she tortured herself with the notion that he might have called for help, and she had not heard him, a classical station playing loudly while she read a British mystery novel down below. Her eyes darted up and down the block when she talked to Nora, ever suspicious that one of the tabloids might be casing her home. Golf club exec beaten by bum heart. It didn't happen. Jack might have once again become a page five story, but the mayor's wife had recently left him for a woman, who I know personally, and believe me, she is a million times nicer and smarter than he is, Jenny had told Nora on the phone. And a photogenic 25-year-old divinity student had been assaulted while she biked to class. Bibi had once told Nora that that was the best you could hope for when there was bad publicity, that something worse would come along. And she had been right. Sherry had even decided against a memorial service. The memorial service had become the new funeral in New York City. No coffin, no body. The deceased was already long gone to the crematorium by the time some public venue hosted what was called a remembrance or a celebration of life. Nora and Charlie knew the drill by now. Slightly more than an hour of anecdotes, favorite readings, a little poetry, perhaps one of the more literary psalms. Slideshows were considered tacky, but classical music was de rigueur, even if the person had hated the Philharmonic, WQXR, and Mozart. Sometimes Gershwin or very modern jazz was acceptable, and several people they knew had had New York, New York as the recessional. Occasionally, a memorial would run close to 2 hours, and then you would see people sliding into the aisles and out the door early, grumbling in the sunlight about how important it was to be respectful of the time commitments of the living. Afterward, there was usually a light lunch. The Fisk family, son, mother, son, brother whom no one knew, gathered on either side of the fireplace in the living room, food laid out in the dining room. Alma Fenstermacher had proffered her caterer, and Nora felt vaguely embarrassed by the passing thought that the food was very good. She looked around for George. This was exactly the sort of event he would enjoy, glad handing his way through the mourners, telling the ones he'd never met before how close he and Jack had been, talking to the ones who lived on the block about how worried he'd been about Jack's health in the last couple of months, how ashen and haggard he'd been looking, lowering his voice to a stage whisper to talk about what happened, you know what I mean? But he wasn't there. Instead, at the Danish modern table, she ran into Betsy, who was eating salad greens with her fingers, dipping each leaf delicately into a small pool of balsamic vinaigrette on the plate. It's nice that you could get away, Nora said. I had to be here. When George said he couldn't do it, just couldn't face it, I told him I would come and offer condolences. He's having a hard time? Terrible. And he says he doesn't know what he'd do without Charlie. He says Charlie's friendship has been a godsend. Really? Said Nora. Even to her it sounded like, really? He's been a rock for George. Betsy put down her plate and took a phone from the pocket of her black cardigan. Then she took another from the pocket on the other side. Excuse me, Nora, she said. Nora had to admit to herself afterward that she went looking for Charlie then only to be snide, to say, wait until you hear this one. You're a rock, a godsend. In the den, a clutch of men who looked like Jack's partners were watching a Mets game on the flat screen. It must be that they didn't know that that was the room in which Jack had died. One of them was even sitting in Jack's recliner, which Nora was pretty sure was precisely where it had happened. From inside the closed door of the master bedroom, Nora heard voices, and she knocked softly. Alma and Sherry were sitting side by side on the love seat under the window, a box of tissues between them. Oh, I'm so sorry, Nora said. No, come in, Sherry said. I just had to get away for a few minutes. I feel as though I'd been on a treadmill. I never appreciated how exhausting constant concern could be.
Exhausting, said Alma, putting her hand over Sherry's.
Some reporter finally knocked at the door this morning, Sherry said. It must be a slow news day. I was so afraid Andrew would hit him. Think of how that story would have sounded.
That's terrible, Nora said, putting her hand over the one of Sherry's that Alma wasn't holding.
Sherry started to cry. Alma patted one hand, so Nora patted the other.
Some young resident came out in the ER and told me he'd expired, Sherry sobbed. Who uses that word? It made him sound as though he were a carton of milk past his sell-by date. Expired? Who says expired?
Her nose was running onto her upper lip.
That's dreadful, Alma said. Passed away, Sherry said. They could have said passed away.
She wiped her face, then looked down at the pinkish streaks of foundation on the ragged tissue.
Oh, no,
she said. Nora squeezed her hand. It could be worse. George could be here. Sherry gave a harsh laugh that sounded as though it were stuck somewhere in her chest.
He wrote me a long letter, she said. He talked about what a wonderful man Jack was and told some long story about how Jonathan had come here trick-or-treating one Halloween, and Jack had invited him in and talked to him in a way that Jonathan would never forget.
About what? Nora said.
I have no idea. I'm not even sure if it's true. Every time Jack saw Jonathan, he called him that little weasel, as far as I remember.
That was Jack, said Alma.
The other thing that's exhausting about all this is that these people insist on evoking some mythical Jack who bears no resemblance to my husband. His partners made him sound like Mother Teresa until one of them mentioned his golf game when they all shut up and the one man turned purple. And one of the work wives was telling a long story about how a friend of hers had gotten over being a widow through yoga. I hate yoga.
Agreed, said Alma.
I'm sorry, Nora, Sherry said. I've been so mean to you the last few months, but I had no idea how to handle this situation, which is ironic, given what I do for a living.
I totally understood. Sherry lay back on a stack of pillows.
Is it bad form to take a nap in the middle of something like this?
She said. Don't worry, said Alma, and she and Nora slipped out and closed the door. I'm going to get all these people to go home, Alma said, looking at her watch, and Nora was certain she would make it happen. Has she taken something? Nora said. In her place, you or I would certainly do so, Alma said, which Nora thought was true of her, but not of Alma. As they came down the stairs, Nora said, I keep thinking of this mother from the kids' school who was eaten up with guilt because she said she'd fantasized about her husband dying so often that when he did, she felt as though she'd made it happen. Oh, goodness, Alma said. If all the women who fantasized about their husbands' passings made them happen, there would be no men in the world. How were Rachel and Oliver's graduations? Oh, you know, sad, hectic, lots of crying girls, hugging one another. We haven't yet reached the evolutionary point at which the boys cry. I didn't see any, Nora said. But Ollie's friends are all science and math guys. Maybe that explains it. I know Charlie told Jack's sons that if Oliver wasn't in Boston and Rachel wasn't in Seattle, they would be here. But that isn't really true. They both really love Ricky, and they didn't much like Jack before, anyhow. Well, we're not here for Jack, are we? Alma said. We're here for Sherry. And it's after 9. I'm going to clear the room. Nora watched her approach the Fisk sons and then made her own escape out the front door. Where did you disappear to? Nora asked Charlie when she got home. He was sitting in the living room in the dark, and she began to turn on table lamps.
I was sitting out in their backyard, he said. I was out there last month with Jack. We had a cigar, talked a little about the case. I could tell he was feeling bad about what happened. I was sitting out there by myself tonight thinking, one minute we were talking, and now it's not even a month later, and he's gone, just like that. He was really sorry about Ricky. I think that's what killed him. It wasn't the threat of a lawsuit. He just felt like a bad guy.
Nora sat on the couch, her knees nudging his. I hate to say it, she said, but in some ways he was a bad guy.
I don't think so. He just got stuck in a situation and didn't know how to get out of it. And I was sitting there thinking, in 10 years, I'll be him. Circling the drain at work, so pissed off that someday I'll hit some poor bastard with a 3-iron. It's not true. You're not that guy. You'll never be that guy.
Nora put her hand on his back and rubbed it, the way she had with the kids when they were babies, fretful, teething. Charlie turned his head and looked at her.
That's the nicest thing you've done to me in a long time, he said.
Sorry, Charlie. She said it because she used to say that as a joke when they first got together, like the tuna ad from when they both were kids. But it didn't seem funny now. Come to bed, she said.
You go ahead. I'm going to sit here for a while. Just turn out the lights.
Nora waited for a moment.
Go ahead, he said again.
As she started up the stairs, she heard Charlie say,
Nora?
It was so odd to hear him use her proper name. For years it had been Bunny or Bun, as though Nora were a name for other people and he had claimed a singular name just for himself. She tried to remember the last time he had called her Nora. It was usually when he was angry. But he wasn't angry now. When she turned, she could see his big pale hand raised in the darkness, caught for an instant in the streetlight coming through the curtains. He waved it in a circle that seemed to take in the room, the house, the city outside.
I can't do this anymore. I just can't.
He never came to bed. She never fell asleep. And so the day was done, and another dawned. Nora Nolan has moved. Home, 601 West 100th Street, apartment 15B. Office, the Beverly Foundation, 60 West 125th Street, suite 1010. She can be reached by email at nora.b.nolan@nbnolan.net or president@beverlyfoundation.org. Nora and Charlie soldiered on for months after Jack Fisk died, but that night in the living room, something had broken, and it became clear by inches that it could not be mended. When one of you wanted one life and the other wanted something completely different, there was a technical term for that, irreconcilable. Nora realized that she was familiar with three kinds of marriages, happy, miserable, and somewhere in between. Somehow the words Charlie spoke that June evening moved them from one column to another. They started to look around for middle ground and realized they'd been on parallel paths for so long that there wasn't any. One minute you were two people who loved each other despite your differences, and then one morning you realized granola for him, oatmeal for her, skim milk for him, full fat for her, coffee for him, tea for her, that you were nothing but. What do you think of couples counseling? Nora had asked Sherry, who was sitting in the Greek diner on Broadway while real estate agents wandered her house to decide which clients might buy it. I've never known anyone who stayed together because of it, Sherry said. Best case, it stops people from using tooth and claw on each other, which can mean it's really worth it. Do you know someone who needs a referral? Nora didn't know what showed on her face, but Sherry put down a piece of rye toast and said, Oh, no. Oh, goodness. Can I help? Expired, she thought to herself, looking at Sherry and remembering that evening at the Fisk house. We've expired. Charlie drank more and slept less. When he was home, the place somehow seemed even emptier. Jack's downfall and death had been like a dog whistle, sending Charlie a signal that only he could hear about his own existence. It was a happy event that finally did them in, which she supposed came as no surprise. She remembered once telling Christine that at weddings, people decided either to break up or to take it to the next level. They had been at the wedding of friends from high school at a big country club overlooking the Sound. Boat horns drowning out the string quartet, and Christine turned to her and said, I'm going to dump Bradley in the morning. Just like that. She remembered Charlie squeezing her hand during the vows. From this day forward, as long as you both shall live. Somehow when you're saying those words, you never realize what a long time, as you both shall live, will amount to. Jenny had invited them to dinner at her apartment, although Jenny made it her business never to cook, early on saying it was a tool of the patriarchy, and later insisting that with the takeout options in her neighborhood alone, it was simply foolish. I think it's to admire her new kitchen, Nora told Charlie, the two of them sitting side by side in the back of a car like two strangers who left a party and realized at the curb that they had nearby destinations. The cabinets were beauties, sleek to the ceiling, a pine with a showy grain that had been stained to a pale shadow of its usual gold, even prettier than the sample Jenny had shown her. And there was not a takeout container to be seen. Jasper had made a chicken stew with dried fruit and shallots, and a loaf of sourdough bread. Apparently he had a sourdough starter that he had been toting from place to place with him for years. It's been his most enduring relationship, Jenny said, smiling at Jasper, dipping her bread into the stew, at which point Nora noticed the ridged silver band on her left hand. Nora looked at Jenny, then at Jasper, then pointedly back at the ring.
I made an honest woman out of her,
Jasper said, shrugging. Jenny blushed. Nora had never, in all the years they were friends, seen Jenny blush.
What?
Charlie said with his mouth full.
What am I missing here?
The ring looked oddly familiar. He made it out of a quarter, Jenny said.
Doesn't that count as defacing currency?
Charlie said. Really, Charlie? Nora said.
That was a stupid thing to say. Let me see.
Charlie put out his big hand, and Jenny dropped the ring into it. Charlie looked at Jasper and nodded.
That is cool, he said, handing it back to Jenny.
He and Nora looked at each other, and he nodded again, and they had a moment of understanding. We had this once, but no more. It reminded Nora of that moment at the symphony, when there was a silence, and instead of the end of a movement, it means the end of the piece. She was grateful that Jenny was looking down at her ring and hadn't seen. When they had paired off over port,
"The guy knows wine,"
Charlie said afterward. Jenny had said ruefully, "He needed decent health insurance. You should have seen the premiums on his plan, and the deductible was a joke." "Jen, it's fine," Nora said. "It's great. I'm thrilled for you. I'm just a little surprised is all. Just please don't ever tell me he's your best friend." "Excuse me, but you're my best friend. And does anybody actually say that except on television?" She looked down at the ring. "Who gets married for the first time at 48? It's ridiculous. Whatever you do, don't give me a shower." "I had a dream about a shower the other night, weirdly," Nora said. "We were here, at your place, and there weren't enough chairs, so we were all standing." "That sounds right," Jenny said. "And I realized I didn't have a gift, and I was kind of panicked about that, and then I realized that the shower was for me, that I was pregnant again, which would be some kind of miracle." And then looking into her friend's face, she saw a deadness, a darkness in her eyes, and automatically reached out her hand. "Jenny, honey," Nora said, "you're not..." "That would be a miracle, Nora," Jenny said. "But is that... I'm sorry. Am I being ridiculously incoherent here? It's just that..." "Calm down," Jenny said. "It's all fine. It's just one of those things that I realize now I'll never do. Never have, I guess. Like living in Paris? I could still live in Paris, but not that. I look at all of you, and I don't know, after all those years of thinking it wasn't something I wanted, I wonder. But who has a baby at 48? Movie stars. Besides, all this is way more than I thought I'd wind up with. No matter what, I really, really, really like being with him. That's what it comes down to." And that was the thing, Nora thought, as she lay in bed that night, listening to Charlie moving around upstairs in the guest room, letting his shoes drop to the floor, running the water in the bathroom. You had to really, really, really like being with someone. Yet somehow that was a decision they were all expected to make when they were too young to know very much. They were expected to make all the important decisions then, what to do, where to live, who to live with. But anyone could tell you, looking at the setup dispassionately, that most people would be incapable of making good choices if they had to make that many choices at the same time, at that particular time of their lives. Jenny had waited. They had judged her and joked about her and cautioned her and advised her. But maybe she had been right. A younger Nora would have been appalled that her friend, the Theodore Pierce Foster Professor of Anthropology, was marrying a cabinet maker with a sourdough fetish. A younger Charlie had said, "Your sister went to Duke so she could design leggings?" But in the car on the way home, sitting with the estrangement well of the center console between them, they had agreed that Jasper was a pleasure to be with, that Jenny seemed happier than ever before, that Rachel was doing so well working for Christine. The only thing wrong was the two of them. Their hands had brushed in the back seat, and they had both edged closer to the windows, bright with the red of brake lights. They didn't rush it. From the outside, they seemed much as before. They took things in stages, but after a while it became clear that all the stages led to a single endpoint. One evening, when Nora thought Charlie was napping on the couch, he said without opening his eyes,
"I ran into Dave Bryant on the street yesterday. He's doing a stint in London, and he asked if I knew anyone who might want to sublet his place. I said I knew someone who would take it."
Charlie moved into the sublet on the east side, partly furnished. Nora looked at places on the west side, but farther north, on the high floors of high-rise buildings. Ironically, one of the things Charlie had wanted so badly finally came to pass, although not as he had imagined. They agreed to sell the house and, as predicted, made a good deal of money. The windfall was less, once divided in half, but a windfall it was. There was nothing else to argue about. The children were gainfully employed. The retirement accounts were already separate. Nora agreed to stay in the house until the new owners moved in. They each changed the beneficiaries on their life insurance to Oliver and Rachel. Someday, Jenny said, when Nora finally told her everything, Charlie's second wife would be infuriated by that, and Charlie might try to change it, but not yet. It saddened Nora to realize that the one thing that might have precipitated real hand-to-hand combat between them had overnight ceased to be an issue. Nora had poured a bowlful of kibble one morning, and Homer had refused to rise in Pavlovian response to the clatter. She carried the bowl to where he lay and put it right under his nose, but he lifted his head and then put it down again. Charlie pulled their car out of the indoor garage, and the two of them drove together to the vet, Homer's panting loud in the back seat. As she ran her fingers through his pied coat while he stood shivering on the stainless steel examining table, Nora realized that there was no flesh between fur and bone. She kept telling herself that she was assuming the worst, but when the vet came in after the exams, the scans, she knew the news was terrible. She and Charlie held each other and cried, for Homer, and for all the rest of it, as the vet gently pushed the plunger on the syringe, and the dog's heart ceased to beat between their joined hands.
"He was always glad to see me when I came home from work," Charlie said in the car,
and Nora started to say, "So was I." That way a wife was expected to do. And then she couldn't, and she started to cry again. She was still crying when they ran into Linda Lessman on the pavement, Nora with the leash dangling at her side.
"Homer?"
Linda asked, and when they nodded wordlessly, she threw her hands in the air and said, "Oh, Lord, everything is falling apart." "We have to tell the kids," Nora said in the kitchen, pouring herself a glass of wine.
"Can we wait a couple of days?" Charlie said. "I'm pretty played out."
And he trudged upstairs. As far as Nora was concerned, they could wait forever. The afternoon they'd sat down together to talk to Oliver and Rachel would live inside her for the rest of her life. Both of them had been home for the wedding of a friend from high school, and Nora and Charlie had waited until Sunday afternoon so as not to poison the exchange of vows between Emily Sternberg and Jonathan Ward at the Metropolitan Club, dinner and dancing to follow, festive dress.
"Your mother and I have something to discuss with you,"
Charlie had said, choking up almost immediately.
"Please don't tell me you're getting a divorce,"
Oliver said. "God, Ollie, of course they're not getting a divorce," Rachel said. Afterward, Nora replayed those two sentences over and over, wondering if anything either of them could have said would have been worse. Would it have been more terrible if they had both assumed that was the case? Or was it more punishing that somehow she and Charlie had allowed them to think that this would never happen to them, what had happened to so many of their friends. Nora had been in a bad car accident in high school. They'd been T-boned at a stop sign, the little car her friend Amanda had been given for her birthday, rolling twice before it came to rest on its side on the shoulder. Nora could still feel that moment in her body all these years later, the sound of collapsing metal, the hard thrust of the seatbelt along her hips, even a shiny smudge on the dash where one of them had spattered some soda. It was the same with this. She could see the grain of wood on the dining room table, the faint shadow of a circle where someone had put down a wet glass, a spike of light through the upper panes of the French door, and then one of the chairs falling sideways as Rachel stood suddenly and thudded up to her room.
"This sucks," Oliver said flatly. "This really sucks."
"It does, buddy,"
Charlie said. It wasn't anyone's fault, and it was everyone's fault. Nora had been married to Charlie without seeing him for a long time. She realized that they all assumed that if their marriages ended, it would be with a big bang, the other woman, the hidden debts. Nora had had more reasons than most to imagine that, veteran of grand passion built on a big lie. But now, she thought that was an aberration. The truth was that some of their marriages were like balloons. A few went suddenly pop, but more often than not, the air slowly leaked out until it was a sad, wrinkled little thing with no lift to it anymore. Because the children changed, they required attention, drew the eye. The year Oliver's room started to smell like unwashed man, the year Rachel began to shut her door and frown when Nora knocked on it. The strep throat, the failing course. But the sameness of husbands, of wives, too, meant that in some sense they might cease to exist on a daily basis. They were like drapes. You agonized over choosing them, measured and mulled, one of them just right, and then you hung them and forgot about them, so that sometimes you couldn't even remember what color they were. Almost without noticing it, the young man who had kissed Nora on the forehead after walking her home from the tattooed lady had become a sad man who had seen the line of his life running off the reel like it was being dragged by a big fish in murky water. All the men, they feared loss of potency, of position. But what it all came down to was fear of death. Ricky's van might as well have been a hearse. Charlie wasn't a bad man, or even a bad husband. Like most men of his generation, he had grown up thinking that the basic maintenance of his life would be handled by women. And it was, by his assistant, the housekeeper, and, to a lesser and less solicitous and therefore less satisfactory extent, his wife. But arranging things for someone is not the same as loving him. It's work, not devotion. Of course, there had almost immediately been a woman after Charlie had moved out. Maybe she'd even been there during the months when he was sleeping upstairs and Nora was on the floor below. Why wouldn't that be so? Charlie was a nice man, freed from the accumulated weight of the petty grievances of ordinary married life. All her friends said women left because they were unhappy, and men left because they'd found someone new to be unhappy with. Nora realized how far they'd come when Charlie told her he was seeing someone, and she realized she wasn't as upset as she'd always expected to be. The woman was the nurse in his doctor's office. They'd gotten to talking when he was waiting for the stress test during his physical. Nora could almost see it, the woman nodding her head sympathetically. Charlie confiding how hard the last months had been as she put a blood pressure cuff on his arm. She probably played golf, or at least was willing to learn. For her, a golf club would simply be a golf club. "Transitional woman," Christine said. "The one who gets a guy from wife number one to wife number two." "At least she's not younger than Rachel," Nora said. "You sound pretty okay." "I am pretty okay. I just worry about the kids. You know how you're supposed to tell them it's nobody's fault?" "We did, and maybe Oliver believes it, who can tell, but I think Rachel has decided it's definitely mine." "Rachel is fine, Nan. I see her every day. She's doing really good work, and she's made some nice friends." "That's not how she makes it sound when she talks to me. She says all it does is rain there." Christine laughed.
Nani, all it ever does is rain here. Calm down. She's just confused and sad. She told me one night that she's in mourning for her life. That's Chekhov, the three sisters, I think, or it could be the seagull. She knows I was a history major. Christine laughed. I don't think she's trying to test your knowledge of Russian literature. She's just dramatic. She's always been dramatic, although I've got to tell you, she doesn't bring the drama to work. Not one bit, or she wouldn't be doing as well as she is. Don't worry. You're a great mom. She has so much confidence. If I had a daughter and she felt like that, I'd feel like an enormous success. Silence. Nan? Sorry. That was the sound of me crying. Along with everything else, there was the inevitable split from Charity. Nora knew it was silly, the idea of having her stay on once the house was sold, the children scattered, Homer only a tin canister of ashes stuck in the back of a closet behind the shoeboxes. Charity had not abandoned her. She had helped Nora pack Charlie's things up, sent the clothes Rachel wanted to Seattle, put boxes into storage. But then the tasks were done, and it was time for her to move on. She'd taken a job with a family she met in the park the year before everything changed. Nora couldn't blame her. The family had two little girls, ages 4 and 2, who were probably doomed to hear a fairy tale rendering of the perfect manners and unquestioning obedience of Rachel and Oliver Nolan for years to come while they ate their after-school snack. Charity's sister Faith, who worked only as an evening and weekend nanny for a family in Chelsea, had agreed to clean and do laundry once a week for Nora, so at least there was that. Charity said Vance thought that was a good arrangement. Selling the house was a relief, since every time she passed the Fisk house, she couldn't help but think to herself, ah, that is the place where the Nolans started to unravel. Of course, it wasn't the Fisk house anymore. It had sold quickly, and Sherry had bought an apartment in the same building as her office. They say you're not supposed to make any sudden decisions, she said, as she and Nora had coffee in her new living room, with its view of the river, the same view that Nora had had during her morning walk for so many years. Another thing they say that's ridiculous. Has your house sold? It's under contract, but still being shown, Nora said. We had a full price offer in 10 days. It's insane. My sons keep talking about how great it is that I'm not in a place with stairs anymore, Sherry said. They actually say that. Obviously, they're already worried about the widow Fisk and how she'll get around in her dotage. Oh, nonsense. No, it's true. I don't even mind. Thinking of me that way is good for them. She peered over the edge of her coffee cup. I'm seeing a man who lives in my building. Seeing? You know. He's an entomologist at the Museum of Natural History. He's very... Sherry searched for the right word. Sweet, she said finally. I told him my husband was the man who'd beaten someone with a golf club. He'd never even heard or read the story. It was so nice. I met him in the elevator. It means he doesn't have to stay over. I've always preferred sleeping alone, and he doesn't mind. He just goes 3 floors down to his own apartment. The one time he fell asleep here, I woke him up in the middle of the night and thought Jack was sitting by the closet, glaring at me, when it was only the extra blanket I'd thrown over a chair. Nora scarcely knew what to say. She thought Jack Fisk was exactly the sort of man who would come back from the dead and glare at his wife. I don't think Charlie would do that, she said. Ah, but Charlie's not dead, Sherry said. Are you seeing anyone? Oh, God, no. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what happened. Nora lifted her cup. I know it sounds stupid, but it's like we just ran out of steam. That doesn't sound stupid at all, Sherry said. It's actually fairly typical. What's not typical is that while many marriages run out of steam, most of them keep on going, or at least endure, steamless. Nora lifted her hands and shrugged. It was what happened on the block. Sherry said. A statement, not a question. And Nora didn't even bother to disagree. It changed everything. I don't know, Nora said. It feels to me like everything changed, but we're all still somehow the same. Does that make any sense?
Sherry shook her head. I have a friend who lives in San Francisco, in a beautiful new co-op building. Lovely, lovely apartment, so much space and light. Last year they found out the building is sinking. It's already gone down a couple of feet. The apartment doesn't look any different in any way, but she says when she lies in bed at night, she has this feeling like she's falling. It's not rational, but it's real. Is she selling? Who would buy it? Sherry said. I hear the Fenstermachers are selling. Oh, nonsense, Nora said. Nora was not seeing anyone, although she was surprised at the attempts, most for what the twins had taught her to call hookups. Even Jim, whom she'd run into at a restaurant one afternoon, had asked her for a drink.
I hate to say it, but I always thought you and Charlie were a mismatch, he said, shaking his head.
No, we weren't, Nora said. She figured that would make Jim think the split had been Charlie's idea, that she was still pining, but she didn't care. She hated the way so many people acted, as though part of divorce was a happy erasure of the past. Only Jenny, of all people, said, You stayed together for almost 25 years, and you had 2 great kids. Your marriage was a huge success. Don't let anybody tell you different. Bob Harris had called her the week she found her new apartment, as though from 40 blocks south, he could sense the sound of closing documents being prepared.
I hear you're getting a divorce and your dog died, he said. I'm sorry about the dog. Good dog?
The best, Nora said. He'd sighed.
That's a bitch, he said.
I had a Springer Spaniel that was worth 10 of any person I've ever met. Anyhow, now that you're getting unhitched, any chance you'd have dinner with me?
None, Nora said.
You sure?
My husband works for you.
I could ease him out. The fact is, I've been thinking about easing him out for a long time. He's a nice guy, but there's just something, I don't know, there's something missing.
Please don't let him go. He loves his job. This wasn't really true, hadn't been true for ages, but as Sherry Fisk had said what seemed like years ago and was only last winter, without it, Charlie would be nothing. He'd be like a vampire looking in the mirror, no reflection. In their world, a man without a business card was a man who can't get out of bed in the morning. Even Ricky had had a business card. Bob Harris had invited her in to talk that same afternoon, although she had put him off for weeks, despite the fact that she didn't have a job anymore. His persistence was obviously one of the things that had enabled him to be a success in business. His patience, too. He had waited a long time for Nora to come around. He tapped his hand on his desk, thinking, then said,
What if I trade a couple of dinners for keeping Charlie on?
That is cheap and low, said Nora. Bob Harris grinned. And you are married, she added.
Ah, now how do you know that?
I don't know. That way you know things. You're married to your college sweetheart, and she lives most of the time at your horse farm in Virginia.
Alpacas, Bob Harris said. She raises alpacas. You know what alpacas are?
Pretty much like llamas?
Exactly. Except people who raise alpacas don't like it when you say that. It's like Stu Ventner. You know him? He tells me he's on the advisory board of the library. I say, what's the difference between being on the board and being on the advisory board? He says, something, 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 bowl, 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 whatever. Leanne says alpacas are friendlier and better looking than llamas, and you can make things out of their wool. And llama wool is good for nothing. I have no clue whether any of that is true.
He kept on tapping his hand, looking down at it, jumping around, as though it belonged to someone else, finally saying,
The truth is that Leanne and me haven't been what you'd call legally married for a long time now. But don't go spreading that around. I don't want to wind up in one of those stories about the eligible bachelors of New York, which always means the richest bachelors in New York. Then people who do what you used to do show up asking for money, and women who are a lot of trouble suck up to you at parties. Sometimes literally. Hell, forget I said that. Why I asked you here in the first place. I've got all my ducks in a row on this foundation now, and I still want you to run it.
How closely associated will it be with Parsons Ridge?
Not at all. Offices elsewhere. Whole different thing. No connection except the money and me.
The Bob Harris Foundation? He shook his head.
I already filed the papers for the Beverly Foundation. That's what it'll be called.
Because?
After my mother. She was a second-grade teacher.
Nora sat back. Well, aren't you a boatload of surprises?